Welcome, everybody, to the Jerome Stern Distinguished Writers Series. We're glad to have this wonderful turnout.
Before we get started with our readers, though, we do have a couple reminders for you. Please don't smoke in the warehouse. Also, please turn off your cell phones and other noise-making devices. And lastly, try not to get up during the reading. We will have a 10-minute break between our readers. And now, here to introduce our first reader is Heather Bailey. Please join me in welcoming her.
Good evening, everyone. I first met Sindhu at our TA meeting with Dr. Teague. This was a crazy moment. Our group had only 2 days to learn everything about teaching at Florida State University before classes started the next week. Most of us were still in the process of moving. Sindhu was wearing a fedora, and she was one of the first people who talked to me. Not long after that, she invited me and Tom Tooley to grab dinner with her, and while eating a chocolate crepe, we discussed the problematic way that Mad Men privileges the white gaze. This was only the beginning of many beers and many conversations. One of my favorite memories of Sindhu is when she and I and our friend Jess went to Harry Potter World. Sindhu gleefully purchased a wand, a robe, and a hat, and unashamedly wore them for the rest of the day around Hogsmeade. Like any true Slytherin, she was particularly excited to go to Nocturne Alley and browse through the unsavory items at Borgin and Burke's. While there, two shady wizards working at the shop got a hold of her wand and proceeded to make her perform tasks in order to get the wand back, including walking around and roaring like a lion. I soon came to recognize that Sindhu's interest in getting to know me reflects her characteristic friendliness and openness. Sindhu has that rare ability to see a person, to appreciate their complexity and nuance. I know I can say anything to Sindhu, and her response will be calm and open. During our first year, Sindhu was a glue, a magnet that welcomed, invited, and tied those of us in our cohort together when we were still trying to find ourselves, when we were still trying to figure out what the hell we were doing. Sindhu's apartment was a warm place, a comfortable space. Most of the people who I interacted with at those initial get-togethers are still my closest friends here. Sindhu is not just interested in getting to know people socially, she is an integral part of the community of writers here in our department. I can recall several times when Sindhu told me that she was meeting another creative writer for coffee to read their work or get feedback on hers. During the salon readings she hosts, she is always supportive and encouraging of whoever reads, making sure to tell each person a particular detail that she liked about their poetry or fiction. She's even open to letting non-creative writers read, intrigued, I suppose, by the literary voices of those of us who are serious, straight-laced literature people. In her fiction, Sindhu's appreciation for the complexity of people comes through in her creation of characters who have edges and layers. Her characters straddle more than one world, more than one identity, and her prose captures the moments in which these identities clash. Her debut novel, Marriage of a Thousand Lies, follows Lucky, who is at once a queer Sri Lankan who feels trapped in the cultural conventions of her family's worldview while she tenderly cares for her aging grandmother and wants to maintain a relationship with her mother. While there are times in which Lucky feels deep anger and frustration, there are also moments in which she exhibits incredible tenderness. Sindhu interweaves these two facets of Lucky's character seamlessly. For example, Lucky tells us, "I was born bone heavy, my marrow dense like stone, calcium fibers spun tight and thick. People say that I shuffle when I walk, but I know I danced beautifully. The pads of my feet are thick from carrying around the heaviness, and they let me slap the ground hard to the rhythm of the drums." In this passage, Sindhu's sharp prose reveals the complexity of Lucky. She is heavy and light, awkward and graceful. There is a hardness to her that is beautiful. Sindhu's chapbook, "I Once Met You, But You Were Dead," is also a series of conflicting identities and tensions. One of her prose pieces reads, It's tempting to retell my childhood veiled in virginity, a chaste Hindu girl's strict upbringing. But it's a little boy who stands in these pictures, one who is given too much freedom and adored to the point of exhaustion by extended family before they remembered that he would bleed every month. I had short curly hair and wore boy's clothes. In beach pictures, I wear only my panties. I mourn the loss of that flat chest that allowed me to be rambunctious, wild. Sindhu's new novel in progress, Blue Skinned Gods, which I've had the pleasure to read a draft of, is also about a character's shifting identities. Kalki's a boy who is raised believing he is the next and last reincarnation of Vishnu. The novel follows the journey of Kalki from belief to non-belief, from confined walls to cosmopolitan city. The novel begins by suggesting that there is a difference between reality and truth. As Kalki grows up, he begins to understand reality, but he constructs his own truth. At the beginning of the novel, for example, Kalki tells us, "This is how my story starts. I was born. But this is how it really starts. On the eve of my 9th birthday, I woke up dreaming of goat blood. In the dream, I wrapped my hands around the neck of a month-old kid and held tight as it thrashed, then stilled. I pushed my hands through its skin and felt its insides. I smeared the gummy blood on my face, my chest, my feet, until my skin prickled and grew fur, and my nails knit together into hooves, until I was the goat." This moment, like many in Sindhu's fiction, is jarring and jagged. It's a point at which violence spreads into the mundane. It leaves the reader wondering what hit them but wanting more. Ultimately, Sindhu's fiction challenges us as readers because it doesn't give us neat characters or neat endings, even though that would be more comfortable. Sindhu's debut novel, Marriage of a Thousand Lies, is forthcoming in 2017 from Soho Press. She was a 2013 Lambda Literary Fellow, and her hybrid fiction and nonfiction chapbook, I Once Met You But You Were Dead, was the winner of the 2016 Split Lip Turnbuckle Chapbook Contest. Sindhu's creative writing has appeared or is forthcoming in Brevity, The Normal School, Los Angeles Review of Books, Vinyl Poetry, Prism International, Fifth Wednesday Journal, and elsewhere. Sindhu is an uninhibited dancer, a cat lover, Firefly fan, craft beer artisan, true Slytherin, and I'm proud to say my friend. Please join me in welcoming Sindhu to the stage.
Hi, everyone. All right, so I'm going to attempt to read a short story, but I've cut it down quite a bit. Hopefully it still makes sense. This is called Miracle Boy. I sat behind him the day he grew wings. I always seemed to be behind him, in class, in line during morning prayer. Maybe that's why I noticed him in the first place, before the wings, before everyone else did. He was in my third grade class. Red sand always coated his legs, garish against his blue-black skin. He took off his shoes to play in the courtyard at recess and kicked up the sand where grass refused to grow under the tropical Sri Lankan sun. His friends played cricket. They ran and yelled and boasted until under the watchful eyes of the girls who stood by the swings. But he just kicked and kicked at the sand, watching the dusty clouds his feet made. My body wasn't strong enough to play outside at recess, so I sat at the classroom window and watched his feet, the way the sand slowly stained their bright pink undersides. His name wasn't Peter. That's just what everyone called him after his wings grew in. Peter, because the white, downy wings made him look like an angel. Peter, because after he grew wings, his mother converted to Christianity and joined the Catholic Church in front of our school. Peter, because everyone forgot what his name used to be. I know now that in the Bible, Peter isn't an angel. We should have called him Gabriel. But Peter was the most popular Christian name in a town full of Hindus who had never even seen a Bible. So Peter was the name that stuck. Every morning before the wings, he stood three rows up from me during prayer, when we would gather with all the other Hindu kids. The Christian students went to mass in the church across the street, and the Muslim students prayed in the empty gymnasium where they could lay out their prayer rugs. That early in the morning, I felt strong enough to stand in line. I had drunk the raw egg that my mother cracked into my coffee before breakfast in the hope that the protein would fill up my shrinking body. I stood at morning prayer with my heart jumping in a rhythmless pace and watched him eyeing the sand. He shifted his weight and held his fists at his sides, holding in the urge to kick it away into a dust cloud that floated up and up and up. The day that Peter grew wings, I sat behind him in class, watching the way a little pool of sweat was forming along his spine. Miss Virginia wrote long division, her chalk clicking against the board, the tail of her white sari trembling with each movement. She barked out names. For right answers, a tight nod of her head as she whipped around to scratch chalk on the board. For every wrong answer, the student had to walk up to her and present a hand, palm turned upward. She rapped it three times with her wooden ruler. She called on me. I kept my eyes glued to the sweat creeping up Peter's back and fought off the way the walls tilted. I gave the answer I had scribbled on my graph paper. Miss Virginia nodded and went back to the board. She called his name. His voice quivered. Wrong answer. He walked slowly up to her as she tapped her bata slippers against the cement floor. He held out his left hand, palm facing upward. Miss Virginia brought her ruler down on his hand. He flinched with his whole body and whimpered at the back of his throat. The force of it knocked him backwards, twisting his shoulders and back like he was about to fold in two. The ruler came down again with a sharp crack. Peter's back popped open like a ball of yarn come undone. His shirt ripped. His shoulder blades shot out, white and slimy with blood. Miss Virginia took a step back and covered her mouth with her hand. One of the girls in the class screamed. I clutched the edge of my desk. The walls tilted, and I hoped I was still sitting upright. No one else moved. Miss Virginia brought the ruler down again. Crack. Peter's little body convulsed. His shoulder bones grew and bent downward. Crack, crack went the ruler. Fuzzy little feathers sprouted on the bones and filled in. Crack, and Peter had wings. White feathers coated the floor near him. Miss Virginia stood in front of him with the ruler. She fell to her knees, her sari pooling around her, and pushed her face into her hands. After that day, I didn't see him for 2 weeks. My skin turned cold, and I wasn't strong enough to go to school. At night, I closed my eyes and watched Peter leave again and again through the school courtyard, the red sand puffing up around his feet with each step, the wings gleaming in the hot sun. Even his mother was too afraid to walk near him. He walked in a space all his own, his back stiff, his starched, bloodied shirt hanging in two strips from his shoulders. When I showed up to school again, Peter had golden hair. The kind of hair we only saw on white Red Cross workers and actors on TV. He didn't come to morning prayer, but showed up afterward in class, trailing behind the Christian students. The other kids avoided him. Miss Virginia wouldn't look at him and never called on him in class. We all took our turns with the ruler, but Peter was allowed to sit in the back, quiet. He sat on a stool and wrote on a little desk because his wings prevented him from sitting at the desks the rest of us used. The other kids had already started calling him Peter. In a few days, the three Christian boys in our class clustered around Peter. They followed him back from morning mass at the church across the street from the school, and again from the school to evening mass. They sat around his stool at the back of the class. When he stood under the shade of the mango tree at recess, they sat at his feet. Parents began to linger after dropping their kids off in the mornings, loitering outside the wrought iron gates of the campus to catch a glimpse of Peter. One day, a bully in our class taunted Peter. Krishna the bully, large-faced and gangly-armed, was a year older than the rest of the kids in our grade because he had been held back. He pointed at Peter under the mango tree at recess. "You're a demon child," Krishna said. The other kids stopped playing. Krishna had broken the silence that Peter and his wings demanded. "You're a demon child," Krishna said again. He put his hands on his thin hips and looked around at the crowd of kids. Peter didn't turn around. He continued to watch the cricket game, though the boys had stopped playing and had turned their attention to Krishna. The three Christian boys flanked Peter and stared Krishna down. Krishna walked toward them, his hands never leaving the sides of his uniform shorts. Anton, small and pale with a nose like a sinkhole, balled up his fist and shook it at Krishna. Peter didn't turn around, but his wings shivered and shook loose some white feathers that floated to the ground. Krishna stopped a few yards away from the mango tree and pointed a thick finger at Peter. "Demon child!" Anton ran at Krishna, his small fist flying, his face pulled tight in toward his nose. Krishna's hands rose up. In one hit from Krishna, little Anton fell, his body making a cloud in the sand. Peter's wings unfolded above his head, whipping him around, shaking the branches of the mango tree. The wings stretched out behind him, gathering the air, and snapped forward, sending it gushing toward Krishna. The wings flapped once, twice, three times. Air and sand lashed around Peter. Krishna stepped back. He shielded his eyes against the wind and ran. Peter's wings stopped flapping and folded back behind his body. Anton lay still on the ground, his head nestled in between rocks. A white feather landed on his chest. Anton coughed. Peter's two other boys knelt down, scooping up more and more of the feathers that had fallen and dumping them on the fallen boy. Feathers and red sand, and little Anton coughed and coughed and sat up. This was Peter's first miracle. The next day at school, I heard a rumor from my best friend Mina, who heard it from another girl in our class, who heard it from her mother, that Peter had given one of his feathers to the homeless man who stood outside of the Hindu temple near our school. We knew of this man, with his crutches and the dirty bandages wrapped around his legs. But after Peter gave him one of his feathers, the man disappeared from his usual haunt, and the rumor went that his leg had been cured. He had cleaned up, converted, and now had a job cleaning the pews at Peter's church. One day, Peter and the other Christian boys didn't show up to class after morning mass. We watched the scene through the classroom windows. Peter stood on the church steps with his wings folded behind him, flanked by his mother and a priest in a white robe. The dark mouth of the church looked, for a moment, like it would swallow them. The crowd surged forward, filling up whatever space was left between the school and the church. A man broke free of the crowd and carried a little girl up the church steps. He laid her down by Peter's feet. Peter's mother stroked one of his wings. With one yank, she plucked out a feather. She handed the feather to the man, who placed it on the little girl's chest. We waited. "She moved," one of my classmates said. I tried to squint to see, but the little girl at Peter's feet was too far away for my eyes to see movement. "She moved," someone said. I still couldn't see anything, but my classmates pointed excitedly at the little girl who hadn't moved. The man in front of Peter fell at his feet, and the crowd cheered. The monsoon clouds chased each other out of town. The sun drummed on our heads when we stood in morning prayer. Peter's place in line was empty, as if his wingless body had left imprints in the sand. No breeze came from the ocean. The sand got dustier and settled into the space between our toes. Peter stopped standing by the mango tree at recess. Instead, he went out the school gates, stood on the church steps with his mother, and entertained petitioners. Every day, Peter had a new miracle. His mother plucked a feather off a wing and bestowed it on each petitioner. Often the petitioners brought gifts, clothes, sweets, sometimes small pieces of jewelry. They laid these at Peter's feet, and Peter's three Christian boys gathered them up under the watchful eye of Peter's mother and the white-robed priest. Many days passed before anyone noticed that Peter's feathers weren't growing back. The stark white bones of his wings started to show where Peter's mother had plucked out too many feathers. She became more and more selective. Mina's aunt, who had seizures, was turned away. Miss Virginia's nephew got a feather, but only because he had been in a coma for a month. The size of the petitioner's gifts doubled, then tripled in the space of a week. Some people tried to buy Peter's feathers. Sometimes it worked. I listened to my parents grumble about it at night when they thought I was asleep. They wanted a healthy kid, but no matter how much they prayed to the gods and goddesses at the temple, no matter how many doctors we waited in line for at the free hospitals, I didn't get better. My body continued to shrink. My heart beat erratically, sometimes painfully. My mother wanted my father to petition Peter. I wanted to tell them it wouldn't work. I wanted to tell them it was all lies, that Anton would have gotten up anyway, that the paralyzed little girl hadn't actually moved. Instead, I shivered underneath my heavy blankets. My nails had started turning yellow, and my lungs wouldn't fill even when I drank down the air. And I thought maybe, just maybe, a feather couldn't hurt. After that, I watched the front of the church closely, wondering if I would see my father's lithe body climbing up the church steps to kneel at Peter's feet. When I'd imagined the scene in my head, I hadn't imagined rain. I hadn't imagined a crowd soaked through to their bones, taking shelter under newspapers and the overhang of school buildings, people pressed up against the walls of the school, black umbrellas held tight against the onslaught of the second monsoon season. My classmates and I were outside for recess, mingling in with the crowd at the steps of the church. My father's yellow shirt clung to his back, the muscles visible underneath the wet fabric. I recognized the way his shoulders rolled forward and back as he climbed the steps. Peter and his mother stood in the open mouth of the church doors, dry under the awning. My father, slowly, stiffly, fell to his knees. He spread out his hands and looked up at Peter. He was too far away to hear under the steady drum of rain. Peter's wings unfolded and extended themselves out. The feathers hung ragged and limp. The tips of the wings tapped Peter's mother in the arm, but she didn't pluck out a feather. The priest walked out through the church doors. He puffed out his already protruding stomachs and said loud enough that the whole crowd could hear him, "Only members of this church, followers of the Lord, can receive the blessings of our angel." My father's hands dropped to his knees. The crowd swelled with silence. The wings quivered. The wings opened wider, unfolding behind Peter's dark little body like he was going to take flight. Only members of the church, the priest said again, can receive the blessings of our angel. The crowd pressed closer to the church steps, their umbrellas held tight. The wind howled through the spaces between bodies. Peter's wings hung, statue-like, in the air. Someone shouted from the crowd. Other voices joined in, their words lost to the wind. The cold rain bounced off my skin and into my uniform. He belongs to all of us, someone said. All of us, others echoed. The priest took a step toward the crowd but stayed dry under the awning. He belongs to this church, the priest said. I stood in the thick of the crowd, bodies pressed in from all sides, blocking out most of the rain. The wet sand ate my slippers. All of us deserve feathers, the crowd said. My father stood in front of Peter and looked down at the quivering wings. Members of this church, all of us. My head spun and my heart jumped to the thunder. I swayed with the crowd. My father reached out his hand and stroked the top of one wing, slowly, following the direction of the feathers down to the very tip. He looked out over the crowd. His eyes swept over me. He grabbed a feather from the wing and yanked it out. The crowd's cheer answered the rumble in the clouds. The priest tried to snatch the feather away, but my father was faster, stepping back into the rain and down the steps. The crowd swallowed him, cheering still. We all moved forward. I stumbled along. The crowd surged against the stone church steps, pressed and pressed until the very edge of it moved to the open mouth of the church and engulfed Peter. Peter's wings lifted up and beat air and rain at the bodies around him. Strong arms lifted me up. My father put me on his shoulders and bore through the crowd, away from the church and the school. As a mass, the crowd pulled Peter out into the rain. Thunder clapped and the wings beat at the sky. The arms of the crowd reined in the wings and pulled Peter to the ground. The priest stood in the open mouth of the church and watched. I struggled against my father's hold, but my head was too dizzy, too full of thunder. You're going to be healed, my father said. He held me tighter and pushed through the crowd, away from Peter. Umbrellas circled in the air, abandoned. Peter kicked at the sand, but the rain had already drummed it into the ground. Lightning split faces into shadows. The crowd swayed to the thunder as it plucked and plucked and plucked at the wings. Thank you.
So up next to introduce Kaveh Akbar is Jamie Ringleb.
Hello, how's it going? Oh, Kaveh, this is actually much better without the thing. You're right, that's good. All right, I'm just gonna dive in. Kaveh Akbar eats at Gumby's Pizza. At Gumby's Pizza. Yeah. Kaveh Akbar eats kickin' chicken sticks. Sticks with an X. Gumby's kickin' chicken sticks are a circle of cheese sticks smothered in buffalo chicken sauce, and I'm pretty sure canned chicken. And if you eat Gumby's kickin' chicken sticks, or any meal, really, with Kaveh, there is a chance that once you are done, Kaveh will ask you to share with him a second dinner of onion rings and fries. Kaveh Akbar is a let's hang out at a buffet for 2 hours kind of guy. One of Kaveh's favorite things to do involves taking a laptop to the cheapest Chinese buffet he can find, putting on a movie, and for the 2 hours it takes him to watch the movie, eating small mountains of as many different buffet options as he can ladle away. And Kaveh delights in his love for these sorts of things. and it's impossible not to delight with him. Dinesh Smith once said of Kaveh that his heart and mind for poetry is a city. I agree with them immensely. And I would add that that city should contain mostly buffets. And that those buffets are places where you can linger as long as you please. Buffets where you can pile up your plate with everything there is to offer, partially because, fine, Gumby's Kickin' Chicken Sticks with an X are objectively delicious. But also because Kaveh's vibrant enthusiasm for what he loves can carry you away. And what he loves carries you away. Which shows, of course, here at FSU and at the literary community at large. It shows with Dive Dapper. It shows in Kaveh's reviews. It shows in his constant support of others' writing. And it shows, of course, in his own poems, which more and more require no introduction. Kaveh's poetry never fails to take on a singular kind of texture, a kind of lifting from the page physicality, one that originates in Kaveh's deeply unique hyper-lyricism, a lyricism that knows how to take on its subjects in a way that feels at once wildly alien and absolutely familiar and intimate. They mesmerize as much as they surprise. And this makes room for the peculiarity and intelligence of Kaveh's mind on the page, a mind that seeks itself, and seeks itself generously, compulsively, devotionally, self-laceratingly, and self-lovingly. His speakers are agents of a difficult, sometimes broken world, and they love the world for this, because they understand brokenness, because they know how to alchemize brokenness into form, alienness into intimacy, deep and daily lacerations into the irrefutable complicity we have with brokenness, which we all must confront in order to do the very difficult work of loving ourselves, devotedly, and finally, and again and again. Kaveh Akbar is the founding editor of Dive Dapper. His poems appear recently or soon in The New Yorker, Poetry, Oxford American, Boston Review, Plowshares, Tin House, Harvard Review, and elsewhere. His first full-length collection, Calling a Wolf, will be published in fall 2017 by Alice James Books. He is also the author of the chapbook Portrait of the Alcoholic, the recipient of a Ruth Lillian Dorothy Sargent Poetry Scholarship from the Poetry Foundation and a Lucille Medwick Memorial Prize from the Poetry Society of America. Kaveh was born in Tehran, Iran, and currently lives and teaches in Florida. Let's please welcome this beautiful poet in person to the stage.
That was really cool. That was great. Thank you, Jamie. I can objectively say that nothing I'm going to read right now is going to be better than that, or that I will enjoy it anyways, hearing anything that I'm about to read as much as I enjoyed that. That was really, really cool. Thank you. It really meant a lot. Hi, everybody. My name is Kaveh. I'm going to read some poems. For the first few will be out of this chapbook, which they have there. Thank you, Sindhu, for that extraordinary reading and for just being an extraordinary human person. Sindhu is, you all have borne witness to the sort of writer Sindhu is and like been swept up in that, but she's also just like one of the great sort of literary citizens of our community. And it's just like an honor to be reading with her. I feel very, very grateful and humble, so on and so forth. Thank you, Matt and Whitney. Thank you, everybody, for being here. This is fantastic. This is like a very, very warm, loving place. I feel very, very among right now, you know? Like I feel very, very among. Like I'd be wearing like one of those stickers that's like mood currently best described as, it would say among. Thanks, guys. This first poem I'm going to read is called Some Boys Aren't Born, They Bubble. Some boys aren't born, they bubble up from the earth's crust, land safely around kitchen tables, green globes of fruit already in their mouths. When they find themselves crying, they stop crying. These boys moan more than other boys. They do as desire demands. When they dance, their bodies plunge into space and recover. The music stays in their breastbones. They sing songs about storms, then dry their shoes on porches. These boys are so cold, their pilot lights never light. They buy the best heat money can buy. Blue flames, swamp smoke. They are desperate to lick and be licked. Sometimes one will eat all the food in a house or break every bone in his jaw. Sometimes one will disappear into himself like a ram charging a mirror. When this happens, they all feel it. Afterwards, the others dream of rain. Their pupils boil. They light black candles and pray the only prayer they know. Oh, Lord, spare this body. Set fire to another. Next poem is called Do You Speak Persian? Theoretically. I have a joke. While I'm looking for this poem to fill the dead air. How does Peter Pan keep flying? He never lands. Thanks. I learned that today. I appreciate your laughter. That was very kind of you. This is called Do You Speak Persian? Some days we can see Venus in mid-afternoon. Then at night, stars separated by billions of miles, light traveling years to die in the back of an eye. Is there a vocabulary for this? One to make dailiness amplify and not diminish wonder. I've been so careless with the words I already have. I don't remember how to say home in my first language, or lonely, or light. I remember only Dilambarat Teng Shode, I miss you, and Shabache, good night. How is school going, Kava June? Dilambarat Teng Shode. Are you still drinking? Shabache. For so long, every step I've taken has been from one tongue to another to order the world. I need, you need, he, she, it needs. The rest left to a hungry jackal in the back of my brain. Right now, our moon looks like a pale cabbage rose. Dilambarat Teng Shode. We are forever folding into the night. Shabache. You ever think about how the like water / beverage cup up on the stage with the person is like a total power play? Like how a clarinetist will like come out on stage and like wet her reed, like she couldn't have done that like behind the, you know what I mean? Like it's just like I have your attention and you're not going anywhere. But in that instance, I really was thirsty. But I mean, it's fun to think about. This is a poem I wrote yesterday. I think it's a fun thing to pepper new stuff in. I don't know. See what you guys... Alex is here. I didn't even see you, Alex. Hey, how you doing? That's cool. He's got like a baby on the way. I imagine he's got to like stick plastic in the outlets and stuff like that. That's cool. Yeah, this is a new poem. It's called I Wouldn't Even Know What to Do with a Third Chance. I wouldn't even know what to do with a third chance. Another halo to shake loose, galloping into the crossfire. Should I be apologizing? Supposedly, what's inside my body is more or less the same as what's inside yours. Here, the river girl clutching her toy whistle. There, the black snake covered in scabs. Follow my neckline. The beginning will start beginning again. I swear on my head and eyes, there are moments in every day when if you ask me to leave, I would. Heaven is mostly preposition. Up, above, around, and you can live any place that's a place. A failure of courage is still a victory of safety. Bravery pitches its refugee tent at the base of my brain and slowly starves, chipping into darkness like a clay bird bouncing down a well. I eat yogurt and eggplant and garlic, water my dead orchids. In what world would any of me seem credible? God's word is a melody, and melody requires repetition. God's word is a melody. I sang once, then forgot. This poem's called My Kingdom for a Murmur of Fanfare. Like, you know the like exasperated utterance, like my kingdom for another glass of water, or, you know, I'm looking at your water there. I can't tell who you are. I don't think I know you, but, like, you know, like my kingdom for a X, you know, it's like that utterance, but for a murmur of fanfare. My kingdom for a murmur of fanfare. It's common to live properly, to pretend you don't feel heat or grief. Wave nightly at Miss Fugue and Mr. Goggles before diving into your nightcap, before reading yourself a bedtime story, or watching your beloved sink to the bottom of a lake and noting his absence in your log. The next day, you drop his clothes off at Goodwill like a sack of mail from a warplane, then hobble back to your hovel like a knight moving only in L's. It's comfortable to be alive this way, especially now, but it makes you so vulnerable to shock. You ignore the mortgage and find a falconer's glove in your yard, whole hand still inside. Or you arrive home after a long day to discover your children have grown suddenly hideous and unlovable. What I'm trying to say is I think it's okay to accelerate around corners, to grunt back at the mailman and swallow all your laundry quarters. So much of everything is dumb baffle. Water puts out fire. My diseases can become your diseases. And two hounds will fight over a feather because feathers are strange. All I want is to finally take off my cowboy hat and show you my jeweled horns. If we slow dance, I will ask you not to tug on them, but secretly, I will want that very much. Yeah. It was like a stifled laugh sneeze. It's Valentine's Day. I don't know if you guys are aware. And this is a little love poem for my partner Paige, transcendent American poet Paige Lewis is in the room. And this is like a goofy little love poem. It's called In the Beginning. Holding a mirror under your nose, I swore I could see your soul. Like a knot in a harp string, it looked hard and pluckable. I wanted to feed you plate after plate of watermelon, even the rinds. I wanted to give you a garnet big as a hand fruit. We were saying words constantly, every day a whole new set, thread count, violin, beef cheek. Half our bones lived in our hands and feet. They still do. They're the ones most likely to crack, to ache like the sky after a storm. I held your face up to my face, your eyes level with mine. I could see through your pupils into the flower, into the mouth of the flower. It said, baby eats what mommy eats. We filled our ashtrays with pistachio shells. We drank hot tea from plastic cups. I think I got three more for you. I like to, when I'm at a poetry reading, I like to, like, kind of know where I'm at in that regard. Like, not even, like, you know, I could be, like, totally, like, enraptured and, like, in this, like, sort of, like, ecstatic fugue, but I still, like, just sort of know, I like knowing where that, like, little ticker is on the thing. So I think we got three more. that was real. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Cool. This poem, yeah. I felt, thank you. This poem's called Vines. Their fat, wet vines creeping into my house, through the pipes and through the walls, gentle as blue flames. They curl into my living. There is ice in my attic, sugar on my tile. I am present and useless, like a nose torn from a face and set in a bowl. When I saw God, I used the wrong pronouns. God bricked up my mouth hole. His fists were white as gold. There were roaches in my beard. Now I live like a widow. Every day a heave of knitting patterns and sex toys. My family speaks of me with such pride. Nunesh Tirogan, they say, his bread is in oil. I thank them for that and for their chromosomes, most of which have been lovely. I am lovely too. My body is hard and choked with juice like a plastic throat stuffed with real grapes. My turn-ons include Ovid and fake leather. My turn-offs have all been ushered into the basement. I'll drink to them and to any victory. The vines are all growing toward the foot of my bed. I am waiting for them to come under the covers. I am the only person still in this house. There is no one here to look away. This poem from the chapbook, I switched to newer poems, and now I'm pivoting back to the old standards. This poem is called "Every Drunk Wants to Die Sober. It's How We Beat the Game." It's true. Hazreti Ali, son-in-law of the Prophet, was martyred by a poisoned sword while saying his evening prayers. His final words, "I am successful. I am successful. I want to carve it in my forehead. I've been cut into before. It barely hurt. I found my body to be hard and bloodless as glass. Still, for effect, I tore my shirt to tourniquets. Let me now be calm for one fucking second. Let me be open to revision. Eternity looms in the corner like a home invader saying, 'Don't mind me. I'm just here to watch you nap.' If you throw prayer beads at a ghost, they will cut through him soft as a saber through silk. I finally have answers to the questions I taught my mother not to ask, but now she won't ask them. As a child, I was so tiny and sweet. She would tuck me in saying, 'Mush pukaradet, a mouse should eat you.' I melted away that sweet like sugar and water, like once fresh honey dripping down a thigh. Today I lean on habit and rarely unstrap my muzzle. It's hard to speak of something so gauche as ambition while the whole wheezing mosaic chips away. But let it be known, I do hope one day to be free of this body's dry wood. If living proves anything, it's that such astonishment is possible. The kite loosed from its string outpaces its shadow. An olive tree explodes into the sky, dazzling even the night. I don't understand the words I babble in home movies from Tehran, but I assume they were lovely. I've always been a tangle of tongue and pretty want. In Islam, there are prayers to return almost anything, even prayers to return faith. I have been going through book after book, pushing the sounds through my teeth. I will keep making these noises as long as deemed necessary until there's nothing left of me to forgive. This is the last poem I'm going to read. It's called "Portrait of the Alcoholic Floating in Space with Severed Umbilicus." You know how, like, when you're like free floating on the space station, you can imagine like they got that like long thing that tethers them to the. That's called the. It actually is called the umbilicus. So like, just imagine it like Sandra Bullock, you know, like in Gravity, like just like free floating, waiting for George Clooney to. You know, I mean, you can probably imagine it without Sandra Bullock, but it's easier with her. Portrait of the Alcoholic Floating in Space with Severed Umbilicus. In Fort Wayne, I drank the seniors, old Milwaukee, old Crow. In Indianapolis, I stopped. Now, I regret every drink I never took. All around, coffee grounds and eggshells, the sweating, a mouthful of lime. As a boy, I stole a mint green bra from a laundromat. I took it home to try on while my parents slept, filled its cups with the smallest turnips in our pantry. The underwire grew into me then like a strangler fig. My blood roiled then as now. Back on earth, frog spit is dripping down wild aloe spikes. Salmon are bullying their way upstream. There is a pond I leapt into once with a lonely blonde boy. When we scampered out, one of us was in love. I could not be held responsible for desire. He could not be held at all. I wonder where he is now. If he looked up, he might see me, a sparkling. I always hoped that when I died, I would know why. My brother will be so sad. He will tell his daughter I was better than I was. He will leave out my cruel drunk nights, the wet mattresses, my driving alone into cornfields, unsure whether I'd drive out. I wish he were here now. He could be here. This cave is big enough for everyone. Look at all the diamonds.